The number 22 is to signify the number of veterans on average that die by suicide every day. And the number's a little bit lower right now, but it's generally about 22. It seems like there's these similarities between hockey and being in the military. You do have to count on the person next to you, especially in a combat environment or even in a training environment, which can be very dangerous.
I'm really thrilled about today's episode where we got the incredible Dr. Sachs joining us. He's not your regular guest. This guy's got a powerhouse of experience in clinical psychology, cognitive behavioral therapy, and a real heart for mental health. He's dedicated his career working with the military veterans, athletes, and even trained other mental health professionals. Dr. Sachs has worn many hats, from leading psychology departments to being the psychology program director at Kaiser University. Right now, he's diving into the psychedelics industry as a consultant and serving as the mental health advisor for the Florida Panthers Warrior, a nonprofit using ice hockey for therapeutic support for veterans. How cool is that? In today's episode, we're tackling a serious topic that hits close to home for many veterans. That is post-traumatic stress disorder, or commonly known as PTSD. But here's a twist. It's not just about the challenges, we're diving deep into the solutions. Get ready to explore the power of cognitive behavioral therapy in addressing PTSD. And we're shining a light on the crucial role of the support and community for veterans transitioning back to the civilian life. So continue watching or listening for a conversation that's not just insightful, but also packed with hope and solutions for those who've given so much to our nation. Hi, welcome back to another episode of The Mindful Space. Today we have Matthew Sachs. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Thank you for coming. Thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Thank you. So let's start from the beginning. Do you mind introducing yourself to our audience?
Sure. So I'm Dr. Matthew Sachs. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist. I got my PhD in clinical psychology back in 2006. And that was actually after I took 5 years off from undergrad to grad school. So I really didn't really know what I wanted to do. I was an English major undergrad. And when I graduated, I did not have like a direction in life. Like I'm talking about undergrad. Mm-hmm. But during those 5 years, I did a lot of different things. And one of the things that I did was started getting interested in psychology and ended up working at the University of Pennsylvania at a lab that was researching cognitive behavioral therapy for anxiety, for PTSD, for obsessive compulsive disorder, and kind of got the bug of psychology, the idea of being a therapist, but also being a researcher. Back then, it's very far from what I do now, I had this idea of wanting to like work within academia.
Okay.
So then I went to University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Great place to go to school. Had a great time there. And then I went to internship at the Palo Alto VA.
Oh, okay.
So that was my first actual experience working with veterans. And I have no military background. I'd never worked with veterans before. But the VA has really good training for psychologists. So I did my internship there. And it was an eye-opening experience. I mean, I am as much of a pacifist as you can imagine.
Okay.
I don't like guns. I was not interested in the military other than it seemed like a good place to do training. But after a year of working in the VA, and this is back in 2006, so the VA was just starting to allow active duty folks to come in and access VA services. Mm-hmm. So over the course of the time I was there, started off working mostly with Vietnam era vets, Korea War era vets, and then all of a sudden through the door start walking 20-year-olds and 21-year-olds and 22-year-olds who honestly had been in country, had been in Iraq or Afghanistan like 3 weeks before. Mm-hmm. And something bad happened, you know, they roadside bombed, something like that. And they got medevaced out to, I think, Longstuhl, Germany, and then sent over to the Palo Alto VA. And so I think that was the moment where I started recognizing these are kids. You know, I was older at the time. I mean, older than them. I was like in my mid-30s because I took the time off. But as much as I was like, I don't like war, you see these kids who had gone to war sort of with an idealistic mm-hmm. vision of what war is. Like they had played Call of Duty, they had watched movies, and the truth is war is shitty. Can we curse here?
Yeah.
War is fucking horrible. I mean, it's just some of the most horrific things that you can experience, I think, as a human being. I mean, I've never been in harm's way, but I've heard enough stories to say that with confidence. I just really connected with the mission of wanting to help these guys. And it was mostly guys at the time. There obviously are a lot of female veterans. Yeah. So fast forward, I mean, that's 2006 up till now. I've probably spent 15 or so years on and off working at different VA installations. Yeah. And then I worked for the Department of Defense as a contractor. And then I spent a lot of time training military psychologists. And
to say that's your specialty.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, cognitive behavioral therapy and working with military populations. And then more recently, working within the psychedelics industry.
Welcome to MindScoop, a new segment of the Mindful Space Show. This is a segment where we like to give you more background information about this episode's topic. Now, when veterans go from the battlefield to civilian life, it's not just about the uniform they change. It's a complete shift in their way of living. We're talking about the challenges they face when they move from military to civilian life, specifically when it comes to dealing with something called post-traumatic stress disorder, also commonly known as PTSD. For veterans, saying goodbye to the military often means saying hello to a new community and finding their place in their civilian world. But trust me, it's no cakewalk. PTSD is like a silent opponent that many veterans have to wrestle with. It's mainly linked to the stress of combat and military-related trauma. The numbers show that it affects a big chunk of veterans, messing with their social life, their physical health, and their mental well-being. Now, research keeps telling us that combat exposure is a massive factor that predicts health and mental problems for veterans. It's like the injuries, the emotional scars, and all the stress from war just piles up. And then there's non-honorable discharge status, which is another obstacle. It makes getting the right care and support even tougher, and it pushes the risk of things like PTSD even higher. Another thing that bugs veterans during this journey is feeling isolated. You see, they miss the sense of community and belonging they had in the military. That's where social connection comes into play. It's not just about feeling close to people. It's like a lifeline for mental health. It really shields them from stuff like feeling super down or even having self-harm thoughts. Now let's get into the climax of this study that I found. It talks all about the relationships between combat exposure, non-honorable discharge, and social connection in veterans dealing with PTSD. They looked at a bunch of things like PTSD symptoms, combat experiences, discharge status, and social connection. The big reveal here is that social connection is like a superhero. It directly lowers the severity of PTSD symptoms. On the flip side, combat exposure and non-honorable discharge makes PTSD symptoms worse, both directly and indirectly by messing with social connection. To sum it up, the key to helping veterans overcome these challenges is identifying problems early and making sure they feel connected to others as they make this tricky transition. The bottom line is that this research is a game changer. When veterans move from military to civilian life, it's not just a change of uniform. It's a whole new community they need. These connections are like a lifeline that gives them strength, resilience, and a brighter future. And now let's go back to our conversation. Let's start with CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. How did you get into this theoretical orientation. Yes, I missed the word. How did you get into this theoretical orientation and how do you apply it now?
Well, the honest truth is it was the first thing that I got introduced to in psychology. Actually, the second. I was reading books by Carl Jung at first, and so I was really enamored with Jungian therapy. And then as I started taking classes at Penn and started volunteering at this research center, got introduced to cognitive behavioral therapy and just started reading all the literature. It has the most empirical backing amongst all of the theoretic orientations. As much as I still sort of hold a certain affinity for Jungian archetypes and dream analysis, that's more of an intellectual interest. From a clinical perspective, CBT is my go-to. It's the most effective treatment for a lot of mood disorders, depression, a lot of anxiety disorders, prolonged exposure therapy, cognitive processing therapy. There's all these sort of different CBT sort of is this heading, and then underneath it are these subtypes of CBT. So dialectical behavior therapy.
There's so many.
Yeah.
For those that might never heard about CBT, do you mind explaining very briefly what it means? I know I say very briefly because we can have a whole episode talking about CBT, but you know, for somebody that's never heard this term before.
Yeah. So in psychology, we like to use fancy words for basic things. So cognitive is thought. Behavior, I guess, as a behavior is a basic word. So cognitive therapy was originally developed by Aaron Beck. And I think the best way I can explain that type of therapy is that people's experience of depression or anxiety isn't so much based on a life event, but it's based on their interpretation, their thoughts about that event. So I fail an exam and I look at my F and I say, wow, I'm so stupid. What a stupid idiot I am. So that type of cognitive appraisal or interpretation is more likely to lead me to depression versus same exact situation, same exact person. I fail the exam and I go, wow, I need to study harder next time.
Yeah.
I interpret this event as this is evidence of my lack of focus and I can do more. So that's the cognitive piece. And then the behavioral piece sort of ignores the cognitive piece and says all that we can look at is what we can see, what we can objectively see, what behaviors you're engaging in. And so CBT is really just the merging of those two. And there's different sort of tools in your toolbox. There's cognitive tools where you will go after somebody's maladaptive thoughts, meaning you'll examine them and look at them and try to say, how is this interpretation, you know, the interpretation that you're an idiot, where's the evidence that supports that? Where's the evidence that refutes that? And then if we're talking about depression, you may also throw in some behavioral activation things like, you know, you're not doing very much, Michelle, in your day-to-day life. Tomorrow, I want you to get out of bed at, you know.
Yeah, just go for a walk.
Yeah, go for a walk for five. So that's a behavioral intervention. And so CBT is just merging those two.
Yeah. I mean, there's a reason why it's the most evidence-based, acceptable approach, and all insurance taking it.
That's true.
I know you went over a little bit of, you know, you working with the military staff and the veterans. Do you mind giving us more stories, or how was that experience? How was working with the military staff?
I mean, I came in to the VA like very much a fish out of water. So I was 32, I had long hair, had a ponytail. I was like a new age hippie kind of, and you know, it's not that you need to be like in lockstep with your clients, but I did feel very different from these Vietnam era veterans and Korea War era veterans who were, you know, these very typically tough, macho-ish, men, but also they had been through shit. I mean, Vietnam era veterans, they're trailing behind them, you know, years of potentially substance abuse, of, you know, divorce, incarceration, homelessness. And then I really do think it was that first couple of times where I saw those 20-year-olds, those younger kids, and you look at them side by side next to the Vietnam era vets, and you say, well, first off, if you go back in history, the Vietnam era vets didn't get that help.
Yeah.
You know, immediately when they came home, they were ostracized. They were, you know, spat on and called baby killer. And thankfully, as a culture, we learned that's not a nice way to treat our military. But you look at this young kid and you look at the older guy next to him, and you're like, if we don't do something now with you, you're going to look like this in 30 years. And I just ended up really connecting with them. And I think a part of my personality was was and is such that I could hear traumatic stories and not have it affect me. Now, fast forward to now, it really did affect me over time, and mm-hmm. I was taking home more stuff than I realized. But at least for those first couple of years, I felt like, you know, I could really be a container and hear those stories and not judge them, not really flinch. I think a lot of folks that have been in combat, they are reluctant to sort of share those stories with mm-hmm. civilians, with people who haven't been in combat, haven't been downrange, because they are concerned that they will be judged, you know, if they had to, you know, to fire on a civilian, but that civilian was about to pick up a weapon. I mean, these are sort of like moral gray areas. And so I was able to kind of approach those therapeutic discussions in, I think, a pretty non-judgmental way, because I really care to help these individuals.
Okay. So you build a really good therapeutic alliance.
And probably more so, I think, with the younger folks. I just had an easier time connecting with them.
Probably the ponytail.
Yeah. No, they still like, they judged me as much as I
swear, bro, it's all good.
Yeah, no.
I well, get you.
They were judging me as not one of them.
Are you sure you're a therapist?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to go back to, I mean, it was definitely like very early on I got that.
You saw a lot of PTSD, I assume.
Yeah, a lot of PTSD, a lot of depression, a lot of substance use. And then I did my, so that was internship year. Then I did my postdoc at the San Francisco VA. So another full year of clinical work. And actually I did get burned out. I had thought that I was going to end up doing a career in the VA, actually, but after two straight years of almost nonstop clinical work, I had not dialed in my own sort of like levels of like how empathetic. I mean, you have to be present in the room. You have to be, you know, sort of open to what's happening, and you do have to find that discipline of having your own sort of release, having your own friend that you talk to, supervision.
Kind of clock out, you know?
Yeah.
Work behind, that's the hardest.
And I was really struggling at that time with that. I really just, so I switched over to teaching. And I was in academics for about 5 years before I finally like got
then you got burned out on
that? No, I didn't get burned out. I just missed the work. I missed working with the military. So then I went back to working at the VA.
When you were teaching psychology, like at a university level?
Yeah.
And how was that experience?
I loved it. Yeah. I loved it. Yeah. That was one of the main things that I got excited about in graduate school. At UNC, you're a TA for one semester. So you're, you know, the teaching assistant. Yeah. But if you want to keep going, they'll let you teach your own courses, which was really cool. As a graduate student, I taught maybe 5 or 6 classes, and, you know, you've got 100 students. And I sort of looked at that as this way of like, yeah, there's some students in here that are going to pursue psychology as a career. And I definitely, they're sort of in your pocket. They're going to pay attention no matter what. Yeah. Then you've got another percentage of students that are on their phones, and there's
no way. Psychology is the elective.
Exactly. They think it's an easy course. But then there's all these folks in the middle where you can help give them some basic sort of tools, basic psychological information that they may carry with them and just sort of disseminate out into the world, like reducing the stigma around mental health, reducing the stigma around seeking therapy. So that was something that was always sort of like a you know, sort of under the radar mission for me. And then I'm a bit of like a stand-up comedian in some ways. And so the fact that I had a captive audience that I was grading, they sort of were forced to like give me like the laughs.
So give me the attention.
Yeah, give me the attention. I'm grading you. Yeah.
That always works.
Yeah.
I know, I would definitely pay attention.
Yeah.
I know something else that you talk about is digital therapeutics. Can you explain to us what that is and how it works?
Sure. So I'll use an analogy that I think most people will be familiar with, so or just a differentiation. So we've all downloaded different like meditation apps from the App Store. I use the Waking Up app from Sam Harris. There's Headspace and Calm. So these all sort of exist generally under the wellness app category. And so those are digital. They're quasi-therapeutic, but I would keep those in the camp of wellness apps versus what is a digital therapeutic is something that's been designed, has been researched, you know, controlled clinical trials, okay, and has passed a certain threshold of evidence to secure FDA approval and or reimbursement from healthcare companies. So that's what a digital therapeutic is, as opposed to a wellness app. A digital therapeutic also can exist outside of mental health. It's essentially any digital technology that is helping to manage and treat some chronic illness. So it may be a glucose monitor that's giving you automatic feedback. That's a digital therapeutic. Or it could be a phone, you know, an app, even sort of game that you're playing that has been researched.
Okay, so evidence-based, researched app or whatever,
yeah.
Technology.
Yeah, or wearable device that's giving you some feedback. And again, the FDA has, I think, only approved, I think there's only six mental health digital therapeutic apps.
I haven't really
apps.
Heard much about this.
It's hard because the research and development, when you think about the pharmaceutical industry, you know, they have these huge, huge million-dollar companies, and when they're researching a new medication, they're always knowing at the end of the game when they show that it's effective, well, they're going to get reimbursed for it. And it's really such a new kind of area that it's a little bit of a cart before the horse. Do we put all this time and energy into research and development as a startup company? Are we going to go right to market? Do we want to go the FDA route? And so it's a bit of a confusing landscape, I think, from a business and a regulatory perspective.
Do you think this is the future?
I do. I do. I think between psychedelics and digital therapy, and specifically how AI can be utilized, hopefully
that's
in very
a big one.
Helpful ways within digital therapeutics, I think you're just going to see more and more of those. When you say, you know, is it the future? I don't think it's going to be 100% of what's going on 10 years from now. I just think it's going to be a much higher percentage than it is now. I think you're always going to have your face-to-face therapy. You're going to have your telehealth therapy. I think those are still going to be going very, very strong in 10 years. You're just going to have, rather than only six FDA-approved digital therapeutics, you're going to have 25.
Yeah. Is there any particular one that you recommend or that you've used?
No, that's part of the thing with digital therapeutics is you actually need a prescription.
Oh.
Yeah, so it's really much closer to sort of like a medication. So it's not anything you could just download on your own. You'd have to get a, you know, for example, Pear Therapeutics developed something called Reset-O, which was to manage alcohol use. And so if you were struggling with alcohol use and you saw your therapist and they knew about Reset-O, they may prescribe you that app, and then you have to go through a procedure to get the link and the code.
So interesting.
Yeah, and then they're going to get reimbursed. You know, it's going to be some sort of out-of-pocket expense, and then whoever is prescribed it is going to get some level of reimbursement.
And how effective are these research-based digital technologies? Is there a percentage?
I can't really throw any percentages out because it's fairly new. And unfortunately, the therapeutics company I just mentioned just went out of business because they spent so much time and energy developing this app, the Reset-O, to pass muster with the FDA, that my personal opinion, having had a little bit of exposure to their therapeutic, it sort of was a little bit clunky and not that engaging. Okay. So whereas your Calm and your Headspace apps, they don't have to worry about the research generation, but they can really put a lot of time and energy into how it looks and how it feels.
Marketing.
And they can also constantly iterate, make changes and updates. And this is also part of the catch-22 with your digital therapeutic is you create it. This is the protocol, and now it's locked as it's locked in. We can't make changes because we just submitted it for approval to the FDA. If we go and start wanting to update things rather than just changing fonts. If we have to, if we want to start doing other things, we now have to go back to the FDA and
start all over.
Yeah, well, or do some sort of resubmission. I don't know all the specifics of the regulatory side. Yeah.
Oh, well, that's a shame that companies are going out of business.
Yeah, that one company already did, unfortunately.
You mentioned now you're working in psychedelics.
Yeah.
Can you explain to us a little bit about your involvement and how mental health and psychedelics are working together?
Yeah, I mean, psychedelics, has a long history. For those who are familiar with that history or who have seen the Netflix documentary based on the Michael Pollan book, How to Change Your Mind, they do a really nice job of going back to the 60s and to the Summer of Love and to the time of Nixon and how psychedelics first came on the scene back then and were quickly squashed by the powers that be, and the war on drugs began, which was unfortunate. So things like LSD and MDMA, ecstasy, and psilocybin or magic mushrooms, those were being researched back in the 60s. In fact, there's a famous study that was being done, I think it was being done by the Army. Maybe the CIA was involved anyway. It's called MK Ultra. And so they were giving soldiers LSD to see how it would affect them. And the idea, I think, from a strategic standpoint was maybe we can drop LSD on the enemy and they'll just sort of fall apart.
Get confused.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's something to that. Having had some psychedelic experiences, I don't think it's easy to really shoot straight, perhaps. But at any rate, that research really got put in the closet for 30 years and then only started up recently, maybe 10, 15 years ago, out of John Hopkins University. Is it John Hopkins or Johns Hopkins?
I think it's John Hopkins.
John Hopkins. Roland Griffiths, who is really, I think, one of the pioneers in the field, was really the first guy to say, you know what, this stuff, let's open this box back up again. And he was able to get approval to attempt to treat folks with late stage cancer diagnoses who were going through, unsurprisingly, existential crises and depression and anxiety. And so he was able to get approval to do some research with psilocybin. And that research was really, had great results. And then that led to...
Yeah, just started.
Yeah, that led to more and more
rolling.
Yeah, research. And then more recently, maybe I guess about in the past 5 or 7 or 8 years, there's been a lot of investment going on and a lot of capital being raised. And so I worked for one of the big... psychedelics companies that's called Atai Life Sciences. And they're one of, I think, 3 or 4 companies that are big enough that they're actually listed on the stock exchange. And so what they and other companies are doing is they have several different psychedelic compounds that they have targeted for different disorders. So for example, some of the research I'm still working on is using this psychedelic compound called ibogaine to treat opioid use disorder.
Okay.
Another psychedelic, MDMA, the one that's actually the farthest along is as far as crossing the FDA finish line, MDMA or ecstasy is being used to treat PTSD. So my involvement came once the Griffiths research started coming out, I was just immediately drawn to it. I had had my own personal psychedelics experiences in college, going to Grateful Dead shows, very recreational, non-therapeutic. But I'd done it enough, and I think my mind, I had such an open mind back then that even back then as a youngster, I saw that there was potential here. I saw that that. And I did a lot of journeys with friends, and we, you have these really in-depth conversations.
Experiences.
Yeah, and some of those conversations were, sort of like typical, silly philosophical discussions, but others were a lot more quasi-therapeutic, going into the depths of like what somebody was going through or what they were dealing with or their childhood. So my eyes were always open to that. And once that research started happening, I was immediately onto it. And I would, if I was at a cocktail party with you, I would have cornered you and talked your ear off about how.
So tell me a little bit more about
all about psychedelics. And then I got recruited. So I had a job working with the Special Operations Command out in Tampa, and it was a job I was loving. It was such a cool job. And then I got this random email that this company was looking for psychologists. And I was like, I'm just going to send an email. Like I spent 5 minutes working on like a cover letter, mm-hmm. which is not as long yeah. as you should spend. You should spend much longer than that.
Like, I'll leave it to destiny.
But I just wanted to have a discussion. I didn't even want the job. I just wanted to talk to this guy who ended up being my boss. So yeah, so started having a discussion and heard the cool stuff they were doing. And so then I started working part-time. I was trying to have my cake and eat it too. I was loving the work with the special operations and I was loving the work with the psychedelics. But after about 6 months, it was such a high level and high intensity environment that I was like, I gotta choose. And so my thinking back then was, well, if that, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats. If I can help with this endeavor to get psychedelics legalized, it's going to help veterans. It's going to help special operators. So that was about 3 years ago. And mm-hmm. so the primary thing that I was doing at a time was working on digital therapeutics to be used within the context of their clinical trials.
Okay. And so now you've been working at this company for 3 years.
I unfortunately got caught in a downsize.
Okay.
They lost a lot of stock.
Till recently.
Yeah. So that was about 5 months ago. And then I was able to hang on to one of their subsidiary companies, who's actually based out of Fort Lauderdale, Demorex, which is run by a woman named Deborah Mash out of the University of Miami, who's been researching this compound of ibogaine, which no one's ever heard of. And she's been researching it since like 1995. So now I'm working with her on some digital therapeutics for her research.
How can this compound or ibogaine help veterans in the future?
Great question. And a real synergy that ended up happening was, unbeknownst to me, when I started at Atai, the first company, they had just partnered with a group that's called VETS, Veterans Exploring Treatment Solutions, which was founded by a former Navy SEAL whose life was in the shitter, had gone through all of the stories that you've heard of about veterans coming home and struggling with alcohol use, PTSD, TBI, okay. chronic pain, suicidality, and ended up going down to Mexico sort of as a last ditch possible, thing to help him, and went to an ibogaine treatment center, totally changed his life. And so he started up a nonprofit called VETS. And so anyway, the company I was working for was partnering with them. What ibogaine's, and so that specific group, VETS, has now funded, I think, close to 300 former special operations veterans to go down to this clinic in Mexico. And
they all have great results.
The treatment response is somewhere above 90%. I mean, with this very, specific subset. Yeah.
That's very impressive.
Yeah, it's huge. And I got to actually meet a lot of these guys, went to a number of like fundraisers over the years. And I must have spoken to maybe 70 or 80, mostly men, male veterans, face to face, just kind of like, tell me about your experience. And out of those 70 to 80, I would say, let's call it 80, 78 said it was a life-changing positive experience. One guy said, I just didn't feel anything, which was very bizarre. Just like he did for whatever reason. He didn't really have a huge sort of experience. And then one person said that it wasn't effective. Okay. So, I mean, this is all sort of anecdotal stuff, but powerful and intriguing enough for me to say, gosh, there's something to this.
There's something going on.
Yeah, there's something going on. Yeah.
Something's happening.
Something's happening. I honestly don't know exactly what's happening.
Yeah.
But it seems to be very effective for veterans who have experienced multiple concussive blasts and have traumatic brain injury. And then on the flip side, it has a long history within the psychedelics underground of being a very effective treatment for opioid addiction.
Okay.
And this is sort of unheard of in the opioid use area, but addictions area. After ibogaine journey with someone who has an opioid addiction, the journey is between 8 to 12 hours. When they kind of come back and they're sort of back to themselves okay. within that first 24-hour window, they don't have any withdrawal symptoms and for the most part, and they have no desire for the most part to go and use again. And so they have...
Yeah, that is unheard of.
Oh, it is. And they have typically about a 30-day window where the ibogaine is... has been metabolized into something called noribogaine, which stays in the brain for about 30 days. And so it's a window of time. It's not 100% effective, but it's yeah. like it's like they've gotten a get out of jail free card for those 30 days.
30 days.
And can you do effective change in your life? Otherwise, you are going to relapse.
Yeah. It's not just about taking this drug. You know, there's
no.
so many factors, especially when it comes to use.
Yes.
I agree. What is the scientific background behind this compound that helps, the substance abuse?
Yeah, the science is, we're really in the early stages. I mean, even though that compound, ibogaine, has been around for millennia, it only exists. It comes from the iboga root, which only grows in this one part of Africa, this country of Gabon, and this one tribe, the Bwiti tribe, has been using this root for, you know, hundreds, thousands yeah. of years. So they obviously weren't running, you know, randomized controlled clinical trials.
No clinical trials there.
No, but enough. Foreigners have come in, and there's a bit of a controversy right now, or they're trying to protect the indigenous population and not just have, you know, the white man come in and
sort of
take over.
And, as usual.
Yeah. So I think there's a real, I don't want to say controversy is maybe an overly dramatic statement, but there are these for-profit companies and there are these indigenous cultures that really have discovered these compounds. And so trying to find a way to allow everybody to prosper and mm-hmm. to get this medicine out to
yeah.
the thousands and millions of people who could use it. So as far as the background of ibogaine, it was first sort of brought to prominence within the East by this one man, Howard Lofsoff, who was a drug addict in New York City in the 70s and would try any drug that you handed him. He was just one of those guys who was interested. Mm-hmm. And he took ibogaine. Someone gave him ibogaine and he woke up the next day and was like, well, hell, I don't feel like using heroin.
Interesting.
Like what? And so it was just that one experience and he became really the driving force behind getting ibogaine on the map. And then between him and Dr. Mash's work, it sort of got more and more popular, although her work had to be done out of the country. So she ran studies out of a clinic in St. Kitts back in the 90s. She did get, I think at the time she was working at the University of Miami, so she had to get some IRB approvals, but she had to run it out of the country because it was still illegal in the U.S.
It's like that with so many other compounds, just the norm, right?
Yeah.
So on top of your collaboration and contribution working with us, you also work as a mental health consultant for the Panthers.
For the Panthers Warriors, yeah.
Yes. Talk to us about that program.
Yeah. So it's a great little piece of this whole puzzle, Dr. Sachs's personal puzzle.
Yeah, you do have a lot of pieces.
Yeah. So where to start? Okay. So I play ice hockey. I'm from the Northeast, from the suburbs of Philly, grew up Philadelphia Flyers fan and played hockey my whole life. And so I moved down to South Florida, started playing at a couple of the local rinks and met this guy, Gabe Accardi, who was just the buffest looking dude that you ever did see. And, you know, tatted up. And then I came to hear, not from him, because he wouldn't tell you directly, that he was a former Navy SEAL. Okay. And he was an incredible goalie. He had won 2 state championships, and he grew up in upstate New York, Rochester. So 2 New York state championships. I think he was in the minor leagues of the NHL before he blew his knee out and then went the military route. But at any rate, he was trying at the time, he was trying to get this organization off the ground, which is essentially a Wounded Warriors program, okay, type program for veterans to play ice hockey. And he hooked up with another veteran named Nick Butterworth and this other civilian, Gary Roskin, and really the three of them put their heads together and put this whole submission package together to USA Hockey, to the Florida Panthers, the NHL team. And the day that they received the letter, the Florida Panthers, I think, gave us a seed startup of like $30,000. Okay. And the day that we got that letter, Gabe passed away tragically. And I don't want to go into the details because that's his family's story to tell, but I think it's safe to say that his death was very much from his military experiences, the scars that he bore, the battle scars, the psychological scars, you know, came home with him. And so it was at his memorial service that I found out that they had just gotten this Panthers Warriors hockey program going. And so I went right up at the end. I said, what can I do? I want to be involved. Cause I had become friendly with Gabe, and just had my heart just really, I mean, I knew him for a year, but my heart just broke for the loss of just an amazing guy. Just a really, from what I knew of him, just such a solid man. And hearing some of the guys that eulogize him, former special operations individuals, the man that was part of the team that got Osama bin Laden was there. So these were operators operating at the highest level for us, for our country. And so, I became the mental health advisor. We started off with 5 guys, and that was 4 years ago. And I can pick my phone up right now and open up our little group chat, and there's about 90 of us now.
Oh, my God.
So I'm one of 3 civilians. So I'm the mental health, volunteer mental health advisor for the team. And it's just a group of veterans that play ice hockey, that have just are just learning to play ice hockey, and it's a way, we call it healing through hockey. And I actually have brought the jersey here to show you
it. Oh, that's super cool.
So this jersey was developed with the partnership of the Florida Panthers. They gave us, like, they worked with us to develop. This is, you know, like their Panther. Logo. The number 22 is to signify the number of veterans on average that die by suicide every day. And the numbers,
every day.
Number's a little bit lower right now, but it's generally about 22. And then up in the corner here, you have Gabe's name and insignia. And so he was part of SEAL Team 10, and then this Latin phrase, putimus viam sempre esse, which means there is always a way. Mm-hmm. So, this just became like a living legacy to this guy that I knew, and everybody, you know, all the veterans that would come to, you know, it was all word of mouth. It's like, oh, I'd wear my jersey, you know, at every pickup hockey game that I'd go to, and if I ever heard anyone mention anything about the military, oh, you're a veteran, you play hockey, come
join our chat.
Join our chat, come to our next event. And so fast forward this many years later, it started in 2018, and we've been to, so there's tournaments every year, there's the Armed Services Tournament, the Disabled Veterans Tournament, and so we've won a bunch of trophies, a bunch of banners, and I keep in touch with Gabe's brother and his family, and we send them pictures.
Nice.
and let them know what we're doing, and it's amazing.
It sounds so amazing.
It's a really meaningful thing that these guys, one of the problems that you see with folks when they leave the military, if they've been in for 2 years or 5 years or 10 or 15 years, you sort of, I don't know, institutionalized is maybe too dramatic a term, but you get used to the rhythm and the cadence of being in the military, where you literally are told what uniform to wear every day. And so things are very regimented, and you're with your group, you're with, you know, your unit. And then when that ends, whether that ends because it was taken away from you because you got medically discharged or you retire, a lot of these guys sort of end up kind of just free,
like lost.
Yeah, lost and missing some of that camaraderie and that
like the community sense.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that's where this hockey program is a really nice thing, because these guys have come together and, you know, I'm the mental health advisor. The truth is, like, I'm nobody's therapist. I'm just sort of like trying to guide things when there is somebody that does put their hand up, raise their hand, so to speak, and say, hey, I'm going through some things. I'll reach out to them. But really the coolest thing is all these other guys are reaching out to him. All these other guys are like his battle buddies and checking in on him. And so I'm just sort of in the background, kind of like encouraging that. And then if they really do like need services, I'll connect them.
Okay. You know, you can connect them to other resources.
Exactly. Exactly.
What have you learned as a mental health advisor in this group, you know, as a human being or as a therapist?
I've learned that the human condition is sort of the baseline disorder, if you will. We all, regardless of being a veteran or what, we all struggle in life. We all, you know, have hard days and better days, and being a person is difficult, and we have people we care about and they go through hard things. And, you know, this is such basic stuff, but like, it's easier to go through hard things with other people, with friends, with people that you can count on, with people that you can trust. And I've said this to some of my friends on the team, and I said, you know, it seems like there's these similarities between hockey and being in the military. It seems like in the military, you do have to count on the person next to you, especially in a combat environment or even in a training environment, which can be very dangerous. I have to count on you, Michelle, that you're going to be doing your job. You know, you're in charge of that sector, and you literally have got my back. We have to develop that level of trust. And there's some similarities in hockey. Hockey has a certain code of ethics. Some people don't like the fighting and the hitting. It is a part of the sport. Yes. We don't typically fight. But what I've learned is that you can recreate some of that closeness and that bond within a hockey team, within a locker room. And it's just been incredible to see these guys, which, you know, men in our society right now are typically not very upfront with their emotions. And to take that generalization a step further, men within the military are even less likely to sort of share what's going on emotionally. There is that sense of, you know, machismo and bravado and looking tough and puffing your chest out. And with this group, we've been able to kind of, they've developed this trust and this love for each other, where they are able to let their guard down and they are able to say, I mean, I can point to these moments in these group chats where, you know, somebody says, hey, my wife is leaving me and I'm fighting for my kids. Yeah. Does anyone, you know, A, does anyone know a good attorney? And B, I'm really struggling, like, just wanted to let, and then you see like five or six emails pop up, like, we're there for you. What do you need? And then, you know, you hear about sort of the offline conversations that people are reaching out to that guy. Yeah. So it's beautiful.
Like a great program. And it's been running for how long at this time?
2018, since 2018. Okay. Yes. When Gabe passed away.
Yeah. Well, if anybody's listening, you like hockey and you're a veteran, there you go.
FloridaPanthersWarriors.com.
There you go.
Yeah. And what's been amazing is we have the support of this, the local NHL team, the chief executive officer skates with us, the entire Florida Panthers organization, the owner, Vinny Viola, went to West Point, Bryce Hallwig, chief executive officer, went to West Point. So there is actually a strong sort of military background.
Okay.
And so there is, I think, a natural affinity or connection with the Panthers, Warriors. And then we've had some of the guys come out, some of the actual players. Ryan Lomberg has been the biggest supporter. He's a current Florida Panther player. And the Panthers went to the Stanley Cup Finals last season. The day before he was getting on a plane to go play in the Stanley Cup Finals, he was in our locker room because we had a tournament, and he was there cheering us on and consoling the team that had lost and celebrating with the team. Yeah, we had two teams, one lost, one won. So to see the professional athlete who has no military background, he's just caring.
Yeah,
and he's created a bond with these guys. He's gone out with them. He's played golf with guys. He goes to the shooting range. Mm-hmm. You know, he just had a kid, and everyone's you know, sending him congratulations. Yeah. And it's just really cool.
Wonderful.
It's like a win-win kind of thing.
Yeah. If I like Tokyo, I would definitely feel it. Or if I was a veteran, I guess not.
But you can come and watch your games.
I can come watch a game and support.
Yeah.
Well, I loved our conversation. I'm sure we can keep talking for hours. For the last message to our audience, what would you tell them if they're either going through a traumatic event, or maybe they're a veteran, or they're looking for the new compound? Just, you know, what would be your recommendations for them?
Well, currently right now, like as we speak today, the only medicine that has been approved by the FDA is ketamine. And it's not a traditional psychedelic. It's more of an anesthetic, a dissociative agent. But you can have sort of quasi-psychedelic experiences around those. So it is very effective for treating depression. We're at a very early stage in the development, or the really solid research development, of psychedelic-assisted psychotherapies. And one of the areas that I'm most interested in is what I'm predicting, and this isn't new, I'm stealing it somewhat from a colleague of mine, Ed Newhouse, who wrote a paper called Behavioral Psychedelics, where we're sort of predicting the fourth wave of CBT, that being psychedelic assisted.
Being included, yeah.
Yeah, cognitive behavioral therapy. And so the term behavioral psychedelics that Dr. Newhouse and Dr. Slavich coined is about how do we take this psychedelic compound and use it in a way where we can maintain behavioral change. So that's why the behavioral piece is real important. It's not just take the psychedelic for some sort of ego better understanding, although that's great for some people. But if you're really struggling with a disorder like post-traumatic stress disorder, or if you're struggling with addiction like opioid use disorder, I think most people will be benefited from the combination of the psychedelic along with something that does have the empirical background that CBT does. And so I say all that, and it might sound a little bit vague, and the truth is it is pretty vague, because we don't have we're not there yet. We don't have established protocols. The protocol that's farthest along, the MDMA protocol that MAPS has been using, it's pretty non-directive. It's not CBT-based. It's a little bit of the kitchen sink. It's a little bit of like,
everything together.
Yeah, a little bit of everything. And look, I'm not going to poo-poo it too much because the effectiveness is very high. But my sort of intuition, my clinical intuition, is there's still gains to be made taking a little bit more of a directive approach. So trying to come back to answer your question, there are really effective treatments available. Forget psychedelics for a moment. There are really effective treatments, psychological treatments, pharmacological treatments. I think pharmacology can kind of get you into a space where you're open to actually do the work. I don't think pharmacology or medication is the only answer. You know, if you're only taking an SSRI for your depression, you haven't really learned anything new. You just learned
to or take processed the, or anything.
So I think in combination with therapy, it can be really effective. So there are great treatments available. Not all treatments are created equal. Do your research. Talk to people that, you know, are knowledgeable in the field. Because it does sadden me when I hear, for example, somebody's been in therapy for 7 years for obsessive compulsive disorder. And you're like, oh, what kind of therapy are they doing? Oh, it's psychodynamic psychotherapy. I'm like, oh, well, we have these really effective exposure and response prevention treatments that can probably treat your OCD in 6 weeks. So you've been doing it for 6 years. That rubs me the wrong way. I mean, not all therapy is right for everybody, but there.
Exactly. Or for everything.
For everything. Before we wrapped up, I did want to give you a little something. So this is something from the Panthers Warriors. This is something that's called a challenge coin.
Okay.
And I don't know if you're familiar with what a challenge coin is. So it's a military tradition. I believe the story is that it came to us from World War II. So in World War II in Europe, you have the Allied powers and the Axis powers. And so if you have English soldiers coming up against American soldiers and they, you know, who goes there and they want to make sure that it's an Allied soldier, one of the ways that they could sort of prove who they were is the English soldiers would take out an English pound. Okay. A coin. So it's a challenge coin. They're being challenged. Who are you? And they show the coin to prove who they were. And so that fast forward to today has turned into this military tradition where squadrons and groups create their own coins and as a sign of thanks or respect to someone that's helping spread the word, they will give that challenge coin to somebody. And so what you have here is the Panthers Warriors logo on the front, and then on the back is the memorial to Gabe Accardi. So we give it like this with a handshake.
Really?
That's like the official way to do it.
Officially.
And then there is an alcohol related aspect in full disclosure. So if we were out drinking at a bar and we were both in the military and if we could both take out challenge coins and whoever has the highest level coin, the other person pays for the drinks.
Really?
So if you have like, you know, a coin from the Air Force, but I have one from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I outrank you. My coin is better than yours. So you're picking up the tab. So I have a number of coins that I've gotten over the years.
Just depending. It's like, what do you do? Okay, let me get this coin.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. It's so interesting. Thank you so much. I love it.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you for letting me come out and talk about the team. And hopefully I can get you in touch with one of the guys to come and tell you their story in person.
We'll love that.
Yeah,
we'll love anybody that wants to come over and tell their mental health story, journey, struggles. That's what we're here for. Yeah.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're good. Yeah, but did we miss anything? You want to ask anything else? We're good? Okay, I'll do the outro. Thank you everyone for watching or listening. Don't forget to leave us a comment, like or post, and don't forget to subscribe. I'll see you next week. Thank you everyone for watching. Don't forget to leave us a comment, like, and subscribe to our channel. I'll see you next week.